Nemoto presents addiction, from sacrament to commodity. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 14 minutes. Addiction's history reaches into the earliest traces of communal life. Before ledgers and laws, clans experimented with plants that altered perception. A healer chewed leaves that eased fever. A priest lifted a bitter cup to speak with the divine. A circle drank a fermented brew after the harvest to bind itself together against winter. Intoxication functioned as tool and symbol, its dangers moderated by myth and ritual. Use was seasonal, observed by elders, bounded by taboos, and embedded in stories warning against excess. As settlements grew into cities, intoxicants became staples and status goods. In Mesopotamia, thick barley beer nourished laborers and accompanied rites. In Egypt, wine sweetened festivals and medicine. Sacred texts in the Indian subcontinent celebrated soma, a mysterious drink of transcendence whose botanical identity remains debated but whose cultural power is clear. In Greece, wine was diluted and debated at symposia, with philosophers praising conviviality while cautioning against ruinous excess. The Mediterranean world knew opium as a household remedy for pain and sleeplessness. In China, alcohol marked joy and mourning alike. Across the Americas, tobacco assumed ceremonial and social roles long before European arrival. These substances wore multiple identities at once: food, sacrament, medicine, and commerce. Religious and civic rules attempted to keep chaos at bay. Several traditions forbade specific intoxicants outright, redirecting appetites toward alternatives. Prohibitions on alcohol fostered coffee culture, for example, as communities sought wakefulness without sin. Municipal edicts periodically closed rowdy taverns and then reopened them under tighter conditions. Over time, authorities learned that outright bans often shifted rather than solved problems, while calibrated regulation moderated harm more effectively. That lesson would be repeated in later centuries on a larger scale. Empires transformed intoxicants into global commodities. Sugar, tea, coffee, tobacco, rum, and opium moved along sea routes that joined profit to habit. Plantations underwritten by enslavement and indenture produced stimulants for distant markets. A London tradesman sweetened tea with Caribbean sugar. A dock worker in Marseille paused for a cigarette rolled with American tobacco. A clerk in Amsterdam frequented coffee houses where news and speculation mixed with caffeine. Pleasure at one end of an ocean depended on violence at the other. Habits became economic foundations. Cravings became policy. Alcohol's story during industrialization reveals how work conditions, urban life, and market access shaped use. Distilled spirits grew cheap and omnipresent in working-class neighborhoods where exhausting shifts and dangerous tasks narrowed available pleasures. Periods like the 18th century gin crisis in London, later dramatized in engravings and sermons, reflected real social panic as cheap liquor flooded city streets. Early attempts to suppress supply through blunt prohibition backfired, fueling illegal trade and unrest. Later strategies that combined taxation, licensing, and hours of sale limits reduced harm. These experiments demonstrated that nuanced governance could change patterns without denying the complexity of demand. Opium's trajectory from medicine to imperial lever offers a stark lesson. Long used as a sedative and analgesic across Eurasia, the drug became entangled with geopolitical ambition when merchants and officials sought to correct trade deficits by pushing opium into markets that resisted European goods. Dependence spread swiftly, social damage mounted, and conflict followed. Enforcement crackdowns met organized smuggling and diplomatic pressure. Wars reconfigured sovereignty, opened ports, and legalized what had been condemned, replacing moral debate with imposed commerce. In the aftermath, opium symbolized subjugation as much as solace, and the memory of that period shaped national attitudes toward intoxication for generations. Chemistry's 19th century advances brought stronger drugs into ordinary parlors. Morphine was isolated from opium, then heroin synthesized from morphine, and cocaine extracted from coca leaves. Apothecaries and physicians folded these potent agents into tonics and tinctures for coughs, insomnia, menstrual pain, melancholia, toothaches, and nervous disorders. Bottles sat on pantry shelves in respectable homes, dosed and redosed without a modern understanding of dependence. Laudanum offered sleep at a cost not yet recognized. Morphine delivered blessed relief on battlefields and afterward installed a reliance that veterans saw as both balm and shackle. Children received syrups laced with opiates. Workers drank coca wines advertised as restoratives. Scientific optimism outpaced caution. Marketing outpaced medicine. Cocaine's arc followed a similar pattern of enthusiasm and retraction. Celebrated as a stimulant and anesthetic, it found its way into patent remedies and fashionable beverages before its capacity to entangle became impossible to ignore. As with opiates, regulation lagged behind adoption. Only after harm grew visible did labels appear, prescriptions become required, and access narrow. The lesson repeated: potency without guardrails becomes a public health problem, and dependency rarely respects class boundaries. Patent medicines thrived in the legal gray of the era. Proprietary formulas promised energy, calm, vigor, or cure. Advertisements filled newspapers with testimonials and bold claims. Without disclosure rules, consumers had little way to know whether the miracle in the bottle owed its effect to alcohol, opiates, cocaine, or combinations thereof. Dependency spread quietly under the sign of respectable care. Women, often isolated within domestic roles and encouraged to treat unspecified female complaints, were prescribed laudanum and similar tinctures with numbing regularity. Veterans with chronic pain, laborers with injuries, and the elderly with insomnia formed additional cohorts of accidental dependents. The social map of addiction did not match moral caricatures. It matched access and advice. Public responses evolved unevenly. Reformers demanded accuracy in labeling and limits on unsafe claims. Journalists exposed abuses. Medical societies debated standards. Governments began to move. Laws requiring disclosure of ingredients cut into the market for cure-alls. Narcotics acts restricted opiates and cocaine to prescribed, documented channels. International conferences sought coordinated control of trade. These measures did not extinguish demand but shifted it, channeling some use toward medical oversight and pushing the rest into illicit markets. Smuggling grew sophisticated, enforcement struggled, and the dance between supply and sanction began in earnest. Temperance movements gathered power alongside these changes. Many advocates drew their urgency from lived experience. Families broken by drink, wages emptied into saloons, violence that legal structures ignored. Organizations mobilized congregations and communities, turning private suffering into public action. Campaigns escalated from moderation to abstinence to prohibition. For a time, the promise seemed plausible: remove the substance, remove the harm. Later experience would show the limits of that promise and the unintended consequences of sweeping bans. Even before national prohibition experiments, local dry laws produced predictable outcomes: underground markets, corruption, and a widening gap between statute and practice. Beyond Europe and North America, varied approaches unfolded. Some societies integrated intoxicants into ritual with strict boundaries and strong social sanctions for violations. Others embraced urban cafe cultures while regulating public drunkenness. In places where religious law forbade alcohol, alternatives like tea and coffee structured social time. These differences mattered because policy cannot float free of culture. Where regulation aligned with norms, harm diminished. Where law fought habit without providing replacement rituals or supports, evasion flourished. By the early 20th century, the stage was set for modern battles over substances. Industrial chemistry had delivered potency to living rooms. Global trade had tethered pleasures to profits and profits to power. Reform had created nascent consumer protections and professional standards. Missionary zeal had blended with humanitarian concern to internationalize control efforts. Local prohibition had rehearsed the script for national experiments. Meanwhile, medical voices began to argue for clinic-based responses to dependency, pointing out that abrupt abstinence could be medically dangerous and that relapse should be anticipated, not treated as moral collapse. The vocabulary of maintenance, substitution, and harm reduction had faint outlines, though controversy limited adoption. Culture recorded these contradictions. Novels depicted opium's lure in drawing rooms and dockside dens. Engravings caricatured drunkards while ignoring conditions that drove them to the bottle. Sermons thundered. Pharmacy journals extolled discoveries. Reform tracts simplified complexity into fable. Policymakers absorbed these stories unevenly. Some crafted measured statutes, others reached for blunt instruments. The resulting mosaic was inconsistent, strict in one jurisdiction, permissive in another, producing corridors of supply and refuge that entrepreneurs exploited. The pre-prohibition period also saw the first municipal and state ordinances targeting public spaces where drugs were used rather than the substances alone. Laws closed opium dens and targeted mixing across communities, revealing how prejudice and public health often tangled. Enforcement fell unevenly along ethnic lines, seeding distrust that would complicate later public health efforts. Frequent oscillations between indifference and crackdown made planning difficult for clinics and charities trying to offer help. These early chapters yield patterns that will recur. Substances become problems less because chemistry changes than because contexts change. Potency rises, marketing widens, inequality deepens, and access outpaces education. Blunt bans tend to birth black markets and violence. Nuanced regulation tends to shift behavior without inviting chaos. Shame hides problems until crises force attention. Accurate information and accessible care bring problems into daylight where they can be addressed. Dependency crosses class boundaries when respectable channels distribute potent agents without guardrails. Culture moves on parallel tracks with law, either supporting reform or undermining it with subterranean permission. As the 20th century opened, nations stood at a fork. One path led towards sweeping prohibitions that promised moral renewal. Another led toward regulation and treatment that promised practical gains. Many chose the first path and later reversed course. The reasons for reversal were not mysterious. Underground economies blossomed. Corruption eroded trust. Enforcement overwhelmed courts. Violence followed profits. And ordinary citizens, unwilling to abandon long-standing habits, learned to ignore laws they considered unlivable. The results would shape the next century of policy debates and public health practice. Seen from a distance, addiction's early history is not only a chronicle of vice and virtue. It is a study of how communities manage pleasure and pain, how empires convert appetite into revenue, how science extends relief into dependence when caution lags behind innovation, and how reformers choose between moral theater and pragmatic care. Those choices assemble the world that later generations inherit. When later chapters turn to national prohibition and its aftermath, to corporate marketing of prescription opioids, to wars on drugs, and the rise of harm reduction, the echoes of these foundational patterns will be unmistakable. The past does not dictate the future, but it draws the map that prudent travelers consult before choosing a route.